Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marches, they never change anything.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs, penned in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butz and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play He worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out on the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory, and that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it, and I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul Roof, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth has laid up for me. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. And David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father! I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdraw thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, spit history in hair, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win, because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him, and talk with him, and work with them and speak together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. President Tipton, Mr. Vice President, Governor, Congressman Thomas, Senator Wiley and Congressman Miller, Mr. Webb, Mr. Bell, scientists, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your President having made me an honorary visiting professor, and I will assure you that my first lecture will be very brief. I am delighted to be here. And I'm particularly delighted to be here on this occasion. We meet at a college noted for knowledge, in a city noted for progress, in a state noted for strength, and we stand in need of all three. For we meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. Despite the striking fact that most of the scientists that the world has ever known are alive and working today, despite the fact that this nation's own scientific manpower is doubling every 12 years in a rate of growth more than three times that of our population as a whole, despite that, the vast stretches of the unknown and the unanswered and the unfinished still far outstrip our collective comprehension. No man can fully grasp how far and how fast we have come. But condense, if you will, the 50,000 years of man's recorded history in a time span of but a half a century. Stated in these terms, we know very little about the first 40 years, except at the end of them, advanced man had learned to use the skins of animals to cover them. Then about 10 years ago, under this standard, man emerged from his caves to construct other kinds of shelter. Only 5 years ago, man learned to write and use a cart with wheels. Christianity began less than 2 years ago. The printing press came this year. And then, less than 2 months ago, during this whole 50-year span of human history, the steam engine provided a new source of power. Newton explored the meaning of gravity. Last month, electric lights and telephones and automobiles and airplanes became available. Only last week, did we develop penicillin and television and nuclear power. And now, if America's new spacecraft succeeds in reaching Venus, we will have literally reached the stars before midnight tonight. This is a breathtaking pace. And such a pace cannot help but create new ills as it dispels old. New ignorance, new problems, new dangers. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who move forward, and so will space. William Branford, speaking in 1630 of the founding of the Plymouth Bay Colony, said that all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties, and both must be enterprised and overcome with answerable courage. If this capital history of our progress teaches us anything, it is that man in his quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time. And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. Those who came before us made certain that this country rode the first waves of the Industrial Revolution, the first waves of modern invention, and the first wave of nuclear power. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it. For the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon and to the planets beyond. And we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Yet the vows of this nation can only be fulfilled if we in this nation are first, and therefore we intend to be first. In short, our leadership in science and industry, our hopes for peace and security, our obligations to ourselves as well as others, all require us to make this effort to solve these mysteries, to solve them for the good of all men, and to become the world's leading space-faring nation. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. I do not say that we should or will go unprotected against the hostile misuse of space any more than we go unprotected against the hostile use of land or sea. But I do say that space can be explored and mastered without feeding the fires of war, without repeating the mistakes that man has made in extending his writ around this globe of ours. There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind, and its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too. It is for these reasons that I regard the decision last year to shift our efforts in space from low to high gear as among the most important decisions that will be made during my incumbency in the office of the presidency. In the last 24 hours, we have seen facilities now being created for the greatest and most complex exploration in man's history. We have felt the ground shake and the air shattered by the testing of a Saturn C-1 booster rocket, many times as powerful as the Atlas which launched John Glenn, generating power equivalent to 10,000 automobiles with their accelerator on the floor. We have seen the site where five F-1 rocket engines, each one as powerful as all eight engines of the Saturn combined, will be clustered together to make the advanced Saturn missile, assembled in a new building to be built at Cape Canaveral, as tall as a 48-story structure, as wide as a city block, and as long as two lengths of this field. Within these last 19 months, at least 45 satellites have circled the Earth. Some 40 of them were made in the United States of America, and they were far more sophisticated and supplied far more knowledge to the people of the world than those of the Soviet Union. The Mariner spacecraft, now on its way to Venus, is the most intricate instrument in the history of space science. The accuracy of that shot is comparable to firing a missile from Cape Canaveral and dropping it in this stadium between the 40-yard lines. Transit satellites are helping our ships at sea to steer a safer course. Tyrus satellites have given us unprecedented warnings of hurricanes and storms, and will do the same for forest fires and icebergs. We have had our failures, but so have others, even if they do not admit them, and they may be less public. To be sure, we are behind, and will be behind for some time in manned flight. But we do not intend to stay behind, and in this decade, we shall make up and move ahead. The growth of our science and education will be enriched by new knowledge of our universe and environment, by new techniques of learning and mapping and observation, by new tools and computers for industry, medicine, and the home, as well as the school. Technical institutions such as Rice will reap the harvest of these gains. And finally, the space effort itself, while still in its infancy, has already created a great number of new companies and tens of thousands of new jobs. Space and related industries are generating new demands in investment and skilled personnel, and this city and this state and this region will share greatly in this growth. What was once the furthest outpost on the old frontier of the West will be the furthest outpost on the new frontier of science and space. Houston, your city of Houston, with its manned spacecraft center, will become the heart of a large scientific and engineering community. During the next 5 years, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration expects to double the number of scientists and engineers in this area, to increase its outlays for salaries and expenses to $60 million a year, to invest some $200 million in plant and laboratory facilities, and to direct or contract for new space efforts over $1 billion from this center in this city. To be sure, all this costs us all a good deal of money. This year's space budget is three times what it was in January 1961, and it is greater than the space budget of the previous 8 years combined. That budget now stands at $5.4 billion a year, a staggering sum, though somewhat less than we pay for cigarettes and cigars every year. Space expenditures... Space expenditures will soon rise some more, from 40 cents per person per week to more than 50 cents a week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. For we have given this program a high national priority, even though I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision. For we do not now know what benefits await us. But if I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival, on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that on the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first, before this dictate is out, then we must be bold. I'm the one who's doing all the work, so we just want you to stay cool for a minute. However, I think we're going to do it. And I think that we must pay what needs to be paid. I don't think we ought to waste any money, but I think we ought to do the job. And this will be done in the decade of the 60s. It may be done while some of you are still here at school at this college and university. It will be done during the terms of office of some of the people who sit here on this platform. But it will be done. And it will be done before the end of this decade. And I am delighted that this university is playing a part in putting a man on the moon as part of a great national effort of the United States of America. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Not long ago, Albert Schweitzer, the great doctor and Nobel Prize winner, was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, "Doctor, what's wrong with men today?" The great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, "Men simply don't think." And it's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you asked any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you that he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich. 4 will be financially independent, 5 will still be working, 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only 5 make the grade. Why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the definition. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice, it is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity. People acting like everyone else, without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 14 million people 65 years of age and over. And about 13 million of these 14 million are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now, we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually, by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet, by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95% who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they don't know, really. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked this question. Why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, everyone goes to work in the morning. And that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only man who succeeds is the man who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the man who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the school teacher who's teaching school because that's what she wanted to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only 1 out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. Now, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular, and others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who is a failure tends to continue to fail? It's because of goals. Some of us have them, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. Now think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it will take. It has a definite goal. 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it, or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach, a derelict. It can't go any place because it has no destination and no guidance. It's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There is no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen, and they reward those men. The sky is the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said, the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim for. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You'll suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line. And from now on, you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success, and the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It is only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. He said, "A man's life is what his thoughts make of it." Disraeli said this, "Everything comes if a man will only wait. I have brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment." Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." And he also said, "We need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interest in it will be those which characterize belief." He also said this, "If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things, and wish them exclusively, and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly." In the Bible you read, in Mark 9:23, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." Dr. Norman Vincent Peale said this, "This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I've found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest discovery, outside of my relationship to God. And the great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you'll get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact, which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed." William Shakespeare put it this way, "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt." George Bernard Shaw said, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them." Well, it's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about. And we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration, fear, anxiety, and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works, as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land, because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn, the other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what is planted. As it's written in the Bible, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Remember, the land doesn't care. It will return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants, one corn, one poison. Now, the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success? Failure. A concrete, worthwhile goal? Or confusion, misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it will return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on the earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything we want to plant. Now you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they've figured out an answer to that, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free. And things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our mind, our soul, our body, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends. All these priceless possessions are free, but the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it, but the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used merely because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% of our abilities. Decide now, what is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you'll ever make in your entire life. Do you want to be an outstanding salesman, a better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company, in your community? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind. Care for it. Work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that is a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up. And it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns. At a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity, far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that is exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through Arizona and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 20 tons of dirt in it, a tremendous, incredible machine, and there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he's ever dreamed of for himself and his family, that very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible. But very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why, for some equally strange reason, it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us, if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our family, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson make a speech, the editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade. And as he concluded his speech, he said something that I've never forgotten. He said something like this: "My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things, among them that people are basically good, and that we came from someplace, and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere. And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you." I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. Now, it isn't going to be easy. If you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. Now, one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Secondly, it's cutting away all the fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. Thirdly, to use all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acre of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. Fourth, save at least 10% of what you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. One, you will become what you think about. Two, remember the word imagination. Let your mind soar. Three, courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. Four, save 10% of what you earn. And action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Now keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something, and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Write down on your card specifically what it is that you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up, and immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. As you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about, and since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit. And new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it'll follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. There will come times when you will feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% is successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think only about what you permit it to think. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You're then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand that all he needs is a purpose and faith. For 30 days, do your best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before, not in hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you'll wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test, with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now you make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you would never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. Don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. Above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some may say, well, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry, fear, and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this record. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family about and listen to what's been said here at regular intervals. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in the mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success. And success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, "Give me heat, and then I'll add the wood." How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build, work, dream, create. Do this, and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, for that is the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. There are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual, but again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce this service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can only end by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets where the lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1, set yourself a definite goal. 2, quit running yourself down. 3, stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful, and instead, think of all the reasons why you can. 4, trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be a success, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5, change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6, act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, David Harold Fink, M.D. Do what all experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test. Then repeat it. Then repeat it again. Each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way, and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a life to win.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world.
As the world's finest horses gallop and play in nearby bluegrass pastures, Kentuckians are harnessing a different kind of horsepower. At Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, Kentuckians are combining the time-tested principles of one of the world's leading automakers with hands-on skill and dedication to build a high standard for quality in American-made vehicles. Each day, Toyota's Kentucky team members put into action the Toyota Production System, known across the world for its quality, safety, and efficiency. Team MK covers about 7.5 million square feet of space, with the equivalent of about 156 football fields under roof. This is one of the most complete vehicle manufacturing plants in the world. TMMK's production process starts in die manufacturing by using everything from computer-controlled laser technology to hand grinding tools. These team members bring the designer's plans to life with quality measured within 0.02 millimeter. Once complete, the dies come to stamping, a shop that covers about 700,000 square feet. The dies will be loaded into one of more than 30 presses in the shop to do their jobs. It takes about 20 hours to complete one of our vehicles, once stamping begins to make the nearly 300 sheet metal parts needed for each vehicle. Stamping's work begins with these giant coils of steel weighing up to 24 tons. Team members on the floor move the coils using a remote control overhead crane. The coil is loaded into one of our four blanking machines, which straighten and clean the metal. Then the machines cut the metal into blanks. The blanking machines cut the steel at a rate of 80 strokes per minute, using a force of nearly 800 tons. The finished blanks are fed into stackers that automatically stop at the beginning and end of each production process for a quality check. This is one of the many times we will check the quality of our vehicles during the production process. Every team member at Team MK is an inspector. While doing their jobs, they inspect the product to make sure that no defects are passed on to their customer. At Toyota, the customer is not only the person who buys the finished vehicle, but also the next team member in the production process. When blanks pass inspection, they're moved to storage by a forklift operator. They stay there until they're needed on the stamping lines. Then the driver will deliver the blanks to the press. In stamping, Team MK uses more than 20 automated press lines and more than 30 presses, loaded with some 900 dies. Weighing as much as 40 tons each, these dies come together with up to 2,600 tons of pressure to bend, shape, and trim the blanks into formed vehicle parts. To withstand an impact so strong, the floor beneath the presses is nearly 3 feet of solid concrete. The larger presses also rest on several concrete pillars that go as deep as 30 feet below the shop floor. In this basement, metal scraps trimmed from the parts during stamping fall onto a conveyor and are collected for recycling. Throughout our plant, we recycle and reuse as much material as possible in order to be a good steward of the environment. When a different part is needed, die changes are required. For many plants, this is a time-consuming process, but at Team MK, we have the process down to about 10 minutes. At the end of our stamping lines, team members inspect the parts as they come off the presses. Once approved, the parts are stored for a short time until they're needed by our body weld department. In about 2 hours, body weld builds a complete body shell. This shop covers about 1 million square feet and is the most automated part of our plant. Its team members work with some 700 robots. Body weld is divided into four lines: underbody respot, underbody tacking, main framing body, and body shell. Here in the underbody respot line, three major sections of the underbody come together: the engine compartment, the front floor, and the rear floor. Then the underbody will move to the main framing body line, where it will join to the quarter panels, the roof, the cowl, and the upper back of the vehicle. Alongside team members, more than 70 computer-controlled robots perform the thousands of precision welds required on this line. Next, the vehicle bodies are lifted onto the overhead conveyor and taken to the body shell line, the last line in body weld. On the body shell line, team members attach various parts, including trunk lids, doors, hoods, and fenders. After final inspection and approval, completed body shells travel by conveyor to our paint shop, or they may head to shipping. If they are among the more than 350 replacement parts that our stamping and body weld shops supply to dealers and other customers around the world, these shops produce repair parts for our vehicles for at least 10 years after Team MK stops production of a model. Here in paint, a body shell gets what will be one of the vehicle's most defining qualities, its color. And we guard the quality of that paint job very closely. Throughout paint, care is taken to keep debris out, because even one speck of dust can ruin a paint finish. As team members enter the shop, they don special lint-free clothing and walk through an air blow room. The air removes any loose hair, thread, or material that may diminish the quality of our paint jobs. These team members working in paint also must be mindful of how personal products might affect the paint process. Our paint process takes about 10.5 hours to complete, starting when a completed body shell is pulled from body weld. The pull system is an aspect of the Toyota Production System's just-in-time concept. When material or a component, like a body shell, is needed, it's pulled to the shop, not pushed, as in many traditional manufacturing facilities. By pulling instead of pushing, we produce only what we need, when we need it, and in the amount needed. Painting at Toyota involves 8 basic processes, but first the body shell must be cleaned. A series of dips into tanks removes dirt, grease, and other contaminants from the surface. Then the painting begins with a dip into the phosphate tank, a process that etches the body shell so primer and top coat will better adhere to it. Next is the ED dip. Electrodeposition is an electronically charged primer that permanently bonds to the shell. After ED, the body goes through a series of rinses, then is oven baked at nearly 500 degrees. Next, in dry sand and sealing, team members smooth rough spots on the body surface. Then robots apply a seam sealer to prevent corrosion and water leaks. The fourth process in paint is anti-chip. Here, a coating is applied to the bottom of our vehicles where they will receive the most road damage. In the next process, primer is applied to smooth out the appearance of previous layers. Then the body shell is baked again, this time at more than 250 degrees. The sixth process in paint is wet sand. Here, the shell will get its final preparation before painting, with team members inspecting it and removing any last imperfections. Next, the vehicle gets its top coat in one of 3 paint booths. This area is another example of Toyota's commitment to the environment. Our paint robots use a unique cartridge and water-based system that lets them quickly switch between paint colors with little waste of paint or the use of harsh chemicals. The robots also are programmed to paint along the contour of the vehicle. This reduces the amount of overspray that enters our reclamation system. Next, the painted shell is baked again, this time at around 250 degrees for about a half an hour. Then the painted body is checked for any imperfections at the 8th and final process, final inspection. There, approved vehicles go to the selectivity bank, ready to be pulled to assembly when needed. While the body shell is being welded and painted, our powertrain shop is building the vehicle's engine. TMMK produces more than 2,000 engines a day on site. We build both 4 and 6 cylinder engines in this 1.2 million square foot shop. Powertrain's raw materials include engine blocks and heads that come from our suppliers. TMMK has more than 350 suppliers in North America, over 100 of which are located in Kentucky. Powertrain machines its camshafts, crankshafts, connecting rods, cylinder blocks, cylinder heads, cam housing, and piston pins from our suppliers' rough castings. The machine components are sent to short block subassembly first. Here, team members install the crankshaft, pistons, and piston pin assemblies. After the engine receives a balance shaft for vibration reduction, it moves to lower assembly, the second assembly process. Next, a team member positions the oil pan just before a machine inserts and tightens the oil pan bolts. If the machine detects any problems, it will stop and send a signal to alert the team leader. This is another key part of the Toyota production system. Jidoka is our practice of stopping production whenever a problem is detected. Many of our machines will automatically do this, and our team members can do this as well to keep any flaws out of our products. Next, a team member installs the timing belt, timing cover, and oil and water pumps. As the engine moves down its line, team members confirm their work and that of previous processes. In the final production stage, the engine gets its cylinder head, wire harness, intake, and exhaust systems. Once completed, the quality of our engines is confirmed in a test cell. Here, the engines are subjected to several tests as team members evaluate them for noise, emissions, and any abnormalities. Approved engines are sent to a shipping room, which holds a 2 to 3 hour supply of engines. Team members of our conveyance team will come to collect the engines that are needed when they are needed by assembly. They'll be delivered just in time. Our assembly plants also get parts from our on-site plastic shop. In this 517,000 square foot shop, team members produce components for our vehicles, including interior trim, rocker panels, manifolds, front and rear bumpers, and instrument panels. Making the instrument panel, or IP, starts in the injection molding area, where plastic pellets are melted and then injected into a mold under several hundred tons of pressure at more than 400 degrees to form the instrument panel's skeleton, which we call a substrate. Nearby, in the slush molding area, molds are filled with a very fine powder and are heated and cooled over several processes to create the skin of the instrument panel. In plastics, IP assembly team members combine the skin and substrate and add padding made of recycled materials, as well as other parts from within the shop and from vendors. Also in the shop's injection molding area, team members make trim for the vehicle's interior and produce the manifold. They injection mold each piece, then combine them using an ultrasonic welder. Robots load the parts into the machine, which uses high-frequency sounds to weld them together. Then the manifolds pass to the manifold assembly line, where they are fitted with gaskets and parts to ready them for vehicle installation. This shop also makes vehicle bumpers. After they are formed by injection molding, the raw bumpers are primed and painted in plastics in much the same way as the vehicle body is painted in our paint department. Rocker panels are also created and painted in this shop using the same process. While plastic supplies assembly with these two parts, the shop also ships them to our sister Camry plant in Indiana and to dealers as service parts. TMMK Plastics ships about 1,000 service parts each day. We supply service parts for up to 21 years after the production stops for a model. The machines and plastics are kept running by the shop's maintenance team members, while another set of skilled tool and die team members repair molds and dies. At the end of each plastics process, team members inspect their parts for quality and then load them onto a parts carrier for delivery to the next process, including assembly. TMMK's assembly shops are the largest in the plant, covering nearly 2 million square feet. Assembly 1, our original plant, builds Avalon and Camry, while Assembly 2 produces Camry and Venza. Each shop is comprised of three operations or lines: trim, chassis, and final. Assembly's work begins when it pulls a newly painted body shell from paint onto the trim line. Trim installs parts largely unseen by customers, like wiring harnesses, onboard computers, and padding that will keep the vehicle's interior quiet. At the beginning of this line, a team member places a manifest sheet on each vehicle. This sheet tells team members which parts and which options to install on each vehicle coming down the line. Here the car also gets its set of keys. They will travel the length of the line with the vehicle. As parts for each vehicle are needed, they are delivered lineside by our conveyance team members. Parts arrive from our suppliers constantly throughout the day, orchestrated by our production control department. Using our just-in-time system to minimize inventories and floor space, the plant typically stocks on-site only the parts needed for about 3 hours of production. As parts arrive, some go directly to the line, like seats, which are already in perfect order to match the vehicle in which they're going to be installed. Most parts, however, are brought here to our dock area, where team members sort and prepare them for the line. They'll box some parts for a particular vehicle together into what we call kitting. Kitting involves parts that are small or difficult to differentiate between models. That kit will be delivered to the assembly line and often travels with the vehicle once it's picked. Kitting lets team members focus on a quality installation. As the vehicle works its way down our assembly trim line, it gets one of its most important features, its VIN, or Vehicle Identification Number. This machine is striking a series of numbers and letters onto a metal plate. This VIN is installed at the base of each windshield to permanently identify the vehicle. Here, a team member installs the side curtain airbag, one of the first of up to 10 airbags that will be installed depending on the vehicle model. One of the first Japanese words and concepts that our team members learn at Toyota is Kaizen. It means continuous improvement and is a hallmark of the Toyota production system. Every team member contributes to Kaizen. Here is a great example of Kaizen. When TMMK began production in 1988, the doors stayed on the vehicles throughout the assembly process. Several years later, following a team member's suggestion, we implemented a Kaizen and removed the doors. Now, team members don't waste motion and time walking around the doors or constantly opening and closing them, nor do they chance being hurt by walking into the doors. The Kaizen also reduces the possibility that the doors themselves will be damaged. And it lets us move parts racks closer to the line, again reducing the team member's motion and time. This Kaizen, developed by a team member, helped improve safety, ergonomics, quality, and productivity all in one. Once taken off the vehicle, the doors travel by overhead conveyor to a trim sub-assembly line called the door line. Here, windows, padding, locks, speakers, and other components and options are installed. With the doors now at eye level, team members can complete their work easier and safer. The doors then head into an overhead conveyor system until it's time to reinstall them to the vehicle on the final line. Meanwhile, the doorless vehicle continues its assembly process on the trim line, where the hood insulation is installed. This padding helps keep engine noise in the passenger compartment and outside of the vehicle to an absolute minimum. TMMK builds hybrid versions of many of its models, and here the main hybrid battery is installed. Weighing more than 50 pounds, the battery is placed in the vehicle's trunk. With the help of an assistant, devices like this are used throughout our plant to help keep our team members safe and injury-free. Trim also installs the headliner, moonroof trim, and visors. Hanging just above the line, near our team members, is an andon cord. Our team members have a certain set amount of time to do their jobs. We call this tack time. If they have a concern or encounter a problem that keeps them from meeting that tack time, they can pull the andon cord and call for help. Pulling the Andon cord activates tunes, lights, and boards that tell team and group leaders that they're needed and where. They'll respond and try to address the concern without stopping the line. But if they can't do that within the tech time, they will pull the cord again and all of production stops. Or, if need be, they'll take the vehicle offline to make any needed repairs. Next, in trim, the vehicle gets the instrument panel that was made for it in plastics. When the IP left plastics, it came to the IP line, another sub-assembly line here in trim. Here, team members install, among other components, air conditioning ductwork, controls, gauges to monitor speed and fuel, stereo options, and the steering column. Once the IP is complete, an automatic guided vehicle, or AGV, delivers it lineside for installation into the vehicle. These smart carts are made by team members and follow a magnetic strip in the floor to their destination. Team members use a hoist to install the IP into the vehicle. Team members also use a hoist to install the rear struts, which can weigh about 70 pounds each. These devices greatly reduce the ergonomic burden on our team members and help ensure a quality installation. Trim also installs the vehicle's axles, parts which are built on site by our powertrain shop. Next comes the gear shift and the rear tail lights. Team members on this line also place the Toyota and model emblems carefully onto the vehicle. With trim's work complete, the vehicle moves to chassis, a line that is elevated because its work is underneath the vehicle. Chassis team members install fuel lines, brake lines, and the engine built just for this vehicle in our powertrain shop. Powertrain supplies the engine block to the engine line in assembly. This sub-assembly area will build up the engine block with the air compressor, alternator, and the vehicle's transmission, along with other components. A lifter holding the engine sub-assembly then moves under the vehicle where it's hydraulically raised into the engine compartment. Team members bolt the engine to the H-frame and body and then attach the axles. The exhaust and muffler assemblies are installed afterwards. Also in chassis, the vehicle gets a radiator, rear speakers, seat belts, and carpet. Here, a quality control team member inspects the work of chassis, helping to ensure that only the best work is shipped on. The wheels and lug nuts are installed by this machine, a nut runner. It's used to ensure that all the lug nuts are tightened to the exact torque needed. The nut runner features a poke yoke. A poke yoke is a fail-safe device that detects defects and prevents them from being processed any further. Poke yokes are used in conjunction with many pieces of our equipment, especially critical processes, to ensure safety and quality. At the end of chassis, the vehicle moves to the overhead conveyor, where a robot places the spare tire into the trunk. Then the vehicle descends to the final line, where robots also help team members install the traditional battery. One robot places batteries onto a conveyor, while the next installs the battery into the engine compartment. Robots also help final line team members install the vehicle's windshield and rear window glass. This final line team member is installing the center console with the help of a floating chair called a raku seat. Another example of our just-in-time manufacturing is our seat installation. When the vehicle bodies leave our paint shop, information is sent to our seat supplier, also located in Georgetown. They build the seats and ship them in sequence to match the order of vehicles on our assembly line. An overhead conveyor brings the seats directly from the delivery truck to final for installation. Then the doors are reunited with their original vehicle. Final also installs the coolant, windshield wiper fluid, steering wheel, windshield wipers, headlights, and the bumpers. The vehicle gets its first gasoline on final line. It enters this concrete block room where a few gallons of gasoline are pumped into the tank. Under these bright lights, team members inspect every inch of the body surface and interior closely to make sure that it meets Toyota's high standards of quality. At the end of this line, a quality control team member drives the vehicle off the line and across rumble strips. These create vibrations, which will expose any rattles or unacceptable noises. The team member positions the vehicle on the tow adjust to adjust the steering wheel, as another team member in the pit below aligns the vehicle. Team members then test the vehicle's functionality on a roll drum. As the vehicles move from 0 to about 80 miles an hour, team members check for proper gear shifting. Next, each vehicle travels through a water shower to check for any leaks. In one of the last assembly processes, the driver's steering wheel airbag is installed. With this installation, the vehicle's airbag system is initialized. Randomly selected vehicles from our daily production are taken over to our audit lab and test track. In the lab, team members run quality assurance tests to check for everything from water leaks to audio system functionality. At the test track, highly trained team members drive the vehicles at speeds up to 85 miles an hour around our track and over special surfaces. This process confirms everything from engine performance and handling to passenger comfort. We inspect every aspect of these vehicles to ensure that only the best quality vehicles leave our plant. Back in the plant, each vehicle rolls off the line. Our customer, Toyota Motor Sales, buys it from us. A film is added to protect the vehicle during transport. Then the vehicle leaves our plant for the marshaling yard. From there, our vehicles are shipped to Toyota dealers across North America and the world. Every day, Toyota vehicles begin as coils of steel. And every day, nearly 2,000 finished vehicles leave Georgetown, Kentucky for automobile dealers and owners across the U.S. and even around the world. Reflecting the skills, ideals, and dedication to quality of thousands of Kentuckians. At Toyota in Kentucky, we've created a new tradition of high-quality automobile craftsmanship and an excitement for driving.
Today we have organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think really that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant, or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all want to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside, I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
This is The Rumor Report with Angela Yee. Rumor has it. On The Breakfast Club.
So listen up.
Well, according to reports, because you know it's about that time when people are submitting their numbers to Forbes, Kanye is worth more than $6 billion. I believe
wow.
They have the number at $6.6 billion. Now, Bloomberg reports the collaboration between Yeezy and Gap is expected to arrive in stores later this year, and that could be valued as high as $970 million. Yeezy is currently valued at $3.2 billion to $4.7 billion. Now, I have these official numbers that were submitted, and I'm going to tell you what these assets are and the valuation of Yeezy for Adidas. Is $3.7 billion. The valuation of Gap Yeezy is $1.6 billion. The valuation of YeezySupply.com is $1.5 billion. He has $123 million in cash and stocks, $100 million in Skims investment, $68 million in buildings and improvements, $48 million worth of land, $10 million worth of artwork, $7 million worth of jewelry, $5 million in cars, $3 million in machinery and equipment, and $1.1 million worth of livestock, which includes sheep, horses, etc.
Okay. Yeah,
his ranch is amazing. Listen, LLC Twitter, do you realize why partnerships are important now? Does Kanye get to that $6 billion net worth without having receiving a royalty around 15% of Yeezy revenue from Adidas? He got equity and royalties in his Gap partnership as well. But to LLC Twitter and everyone who got their business degrees from YouTube University, this is why partnerships are important. This is how you get your company to scale fast and get the kind of capital that Kanye currently has, but keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
So he has his evaluation at $7.16 billion. Now, despite partnering with Adidas for the Yeezy brand, Kanye does retain complete ownership and control. He signed a 10-year agreement to design and sell clothes under the Yeezy Gap label last year, although the deal does exclude footwear, and the current Yeezy partnership that he has with Adidas lasts until 2026.
Hey, man, you know, keep growing your companies to scale.
Absolutely.
You know, keep growing that capital to make all those investments. All those investments you named from the livestock and everything else, that's because he's got the capital to do it, because he's using that capital from these partnerships that he's doing. But keep being happy owning 100% of nothing.
Stop it. Now, you know, when people talk all this, I got 100%. 100% of nothing
100%
is nothing.
100% of nothing is nothing.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's also good to be diverse, too. And you see he has a wide,
very
portfolio. Artwork, jewelry, cars, sheep, horses, land, buildings.
But that's what you can do, mm-hmm. when you act like, as Emmy was just saying, you get 15% of this over here, 20% of this over here, and you use that capital to make those investments and diversify your portfolio.
All right, now good news for Boosie. He is officially cancer-free. If you guys remember, he was asking his fans to pray for him when he went to his annual checkup.
Annual cancer checkup. I come every year. Y'all say a prayer for me. I already said 100 prayers. I'm still going to be cancer-free. My family, y'all say a prayer.